But now, the first question that people will always ask is, how old is the church? And, you know, this is a very difficult question to answer. This is a part of living history. The church here has dates. It began in the time of Edward the Confessor and go right up to our own time. You're standing now in the baptistry at the West End, and this is only 18 years old. Part of the church is only 18 years old. It was dedicated by the Bishop of Lewes in February of 1962 and was very largely the inspiration of the vicar at the time, the Reverend Burns Cox. He was responsible for this enlargement of the nave because the population of the East End was increasing very rapidly. And he also was responsible for the organ, you see, just above the archway there, which he had built in memory of his son, who was killed in a road accident, very tragically, just after he'd left Marlborough College. Well, there we are, 1962. Just beyond that, now, as you go to the east, you reach the nave of the church, which is the mid-11th century, or late 11th century. So there's almost 900 years between this part here at the baptistry and the nave of the church, as it was before then, before that time. Well now, if you want to go up a little further, you'll see more of the history. Now, here we are at the actual nave as it was until 1962. And you'll notice at once that the chancel of the church is at an angle to the nave. Quite a distinctive angle. This, by tradition, is supposed to be the angle of Christ's head as he hung on the cross. Others say that the chancel, which was built at a later date, 100 years after the building of the nave, probably, that they then corrected the east-west direction properly, so that the chancel is correctly east and west, and the nave is not. But then again, look at the pulpit, the carved pulpit there. We know exactly that date. It was made in 1623. It's got the date on it, with the names of the two church wardens. So, you see, years have rolled by, but each generation has made some contribution, and each century has left something of its own characteristics in the building of the church. And the church is the focus of the village, is all. Well, I'd like to take you now a bit further and to see this interesting part here. Now, we are near the chancel steps. But if you look on this wall here, the north wall, you see fantastic arch, and then half an arch. It suddenly stops. Well, one is always intrigued to know what has happened. The story is perhaps not so difficult after all, because the earliest church is not here at all. It's there, over there in the vestry. That represented the first tower church, the tower-form church of Edward the Confessor's time, built probably for Edwin, who owned the manor of East End. When the church was enlarged, that tower church was left, and a new church was built alongside it, so that the walls of the original church are quite distinct from the walls of the present church, his name. And when they came to cut an arch from the original vestry church into this newer church, it began to collapse, and they had to give it up. And so that buttress there is supporting the wall, which was obviously becoming weaker by the cutting of that arch. It was too ambitious a project, and so it had to be abandoned. And there it is, with this curious state that the lower arch there was intended to be an arch, the other is really a buttress for the wall. Well now, we go to the chancel and you see some more strange markings in the chancel. You see here two windows and a twin window over here. And what has happened? Well, the original windows were very small and very high up in order to prevent the wind from coming in and the rain from beating in, because they were usually open windows without any glass. With the increase in glass, the idea was then to have a church as light as possible. And here you see two windows that were cut in the north wall and in the south wall. But alas, the walls themselves began to weaken. And so they had to be filled up again. So here are two windows on this side that have never been opened. But on the wall outside of the church, you can see two window frames, much, much smaller, which were probably the original windows. Now, what else can I tell you? You see two pillar shafts on each side. They represent all that was left of the lancet windows, three lancet windows that were here at the east end. Now, they were taken out and the perpendicular window was added in the 15th century. And it was at that period, about 1440, when the roof and the walls of the church were in danger and had to be repaired. So probably these windows that we looked at here were filled in the 15th century, and the new east window was made. The glass of that window is modern.
Well now, it's time for you to ask me a question.
I think it would be nice to mention here this very modern altar and how that came about.
Ah, no, that was given by the Davis Gilbert, the Lord of the Manor. The manor house, which is at Burling Gap, you probably know about, and they have been there since the beginning of the 19th century. Before that, it was a farmhouse, and way back in the medieval times, the manor house was owned by the Bardolphs. And the Bardolphs were lords of the manor from 1241 to about 1440, almost 200 years. And here, an interesting sepulchral slab. This was a sepulchral cross of the Bardolph family. It has the Bardolph arms, although, of course, it has been very much worn now and was broken at some time.
This is the top of the Lincoln slab tomb.
That's right, yeah. And the Bardolph certainly obtained permission from Henry II to hold a fair once a year at the feast day of St. Simon and St. Jude.
and the church is dedicated to St. Simon and St. Jude. And now, while we are just in this corner, I must point out this grill here.
Sad tale.
Because it is a sad tale.
You know it.
Yes. Yes. Well, undoubtedly the pattern, the pewter chalice and pattern had been that of the priest whose body was found when they were digging here in the end he sent to church. We shall never know why it was taken, but it was a very great loss. And at the same time, we lost the shepherd crook that used to stand there. And that was used by the bishop of Chichester coming over for confirmation. He found he hadn't his crozier with him and used the bishop crook as his own staff. Well, we will never find him again, I don't think. But you never know why they were taken. But it was a sad loss.
So all that remains, which is what we can see, is this little metal case,
yes,
set into the wall, now empty.
That's right, I'm afraid so. Three tombs here, a tablet. The first one is sacred to the memory of Nicholas Willard, Gent, who died on the 8th day of February 1702, in the 61st year of his age. Also Sarah, his wife, who died the 14th day of July 1701, in the 57th year of her age. It is interesting, of course, that only the important people were actually buried within the church and had their own tomb. Outside in the churchyard, they were just buried, and then the ground was covered up, and we have no further trace of them. But in the 17th century, we begin to find tombs outside with an inscription. And some of the early ones are in the 1680s, 1690s, here in the East Dean and at Christian. Anyway, the Willards owned the farmhouse, which was the manor, which had been the manor house. And he was responsible for suggesting that a cave should be lowered down off the cliff, Beltute, to save the sailors at the shipwreck. Well, this cave, not sure really ever existed or was ever made to work, but of course we are very strongly associated with the survivors from the wreck, because Parson Darby lived in his own, or at least it went out in the storm, into his own cave down there at Beltute to show the light. And then in the 1820s, the first lighthouse was built, a Trinity House, on Beltute. So, stories of shipwrecks and the stories of smugglers would always be associated with these things. Now, the other monument here is sacred to the memory of James Differer, Gent, who died the 4th day of September 1791. He was aged 88. And he is interesting because he was one of those people who was involved in smuggling exploits and so on, but who turned king's evidence and then lived in the large house on the edge of the green. So that Dippery's house was one of the big houses of the village. I don't know that there's anything further about James Dippery, but he was certainly very much associated with the gang, not only of the smugglers, but also of the shipwrecks. And lastly, in the other corner, there is the last memorial tablet to the family who now lives in the manor house there of the Davis Gilbert. The Gilbert who lived in Eastbourne came here in the early part of the 19th century and took over a farmhouse there and has since restored the hall, the barn, into Bardolph Hall, which is a 12th century, 13th century barn. But it was a hall originally. It's now gone back to that hall. Well, now, there's the story so far. But I must take you into the vestry because, as I told you at the beginning, that was the very first church that we know of, the brick, certainly the stone church of East Dean.
In walking through, can I just describe, or how would you describe these most beautiful beams that are opened here in the ceiling? They're very distinct.
They are. You see the king post, the two king posts that you see in the centre, and the beams across, are of the 15th century. They are real sturdy classic oak, and they are treated and looked after. But we are very proud of our timber roof, both of East Dean and the little church of Clifton on the hill. Here we are in the vestry, which is today. It was the real first church for the inhabitants of East Dean. You can see what a small church it must be. But then, of course, there were very few inhabitants of this church and village. The walls are 3 feet in thickness. You can see it from the window here. And the interesting part, I think, is this archway on the east end. Because this was the nave of the church, and the chancel, where the priests would be, is actually outside. And that was closed probably when they built the new church here. So, although the apse was known to exist, it has long since been covered up. But last year, it has been uncovered and now is marked out. So, outside the church, we should be able to see the semicircular mark of the wall of that apse. This is the west door of the chapel, and this is a small doorway which was cut when the new church was built. Up above, the royal arms of George the Third, which is in very good condition.
This is a feature of most churches, this royal coat of arms.
Yes. It started from the reign of Henry VIII, when he became head of the church, that they should then put the arms of the sovereign in head of the church. But there are very few of those early times. In the reign of the Stuart, we get many more, and then again in Anne, and Queen Anne, and the early Georges. But by the time of the early 19th century, it had died out. So there were very few after George the Fourth.
There's a short history here, virtually, of the vicars, in the sense that we go from 1846 in picture form till the present day, is it?
Yes, yes, that's very true. And here you see that the first is the Reverend Pinnock, in those early days of photography, really.
A very distinct Victorian figure with his Victorian robe and hat.
Yes. Here below is the Reverend Richard William Burns Cox, who, as I say, was very largely responsible for the building of the new addition at the back to the west end of the church, and for the organ, and for the great deal of work that he did when he was here until 1964. He saw the new state coming, developing in that early days, and was very keen that the village and the new building should be one in the work of the church. And I think his example did a great deal to help the unity of the village. He died last year, unfortunately, but his son, who is the assistant organist at Lambeth Cathedral, can play the organ. We hope when the organ is being repaired that he will come again and give us another recital.
The third one along is a very famous recital, Alfred Arthur Evans, the writer.
That's right, yes, yes. He was a great friend of Arthur Beckett, who was the editor of the Catholic Life, and wrote more articles over that long period. And then his three books, I think his last one was in 1939. That was Arthur Beckett.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yes. The Wonderful Wheels. Yes. No, Arthur Evans' last book was in 1939. Because he'd left here and then and gone to Chichester. He travelled about the country, and the number of churches that he visited were amazing. And I often wonder how many times he'd missed his service at East Dingle or somewhere else. But that may be wrong. But he was a great writer, and certainly was very keen on the history of the church. And the articles that he wrote have often been reframed and put here.
And Arthur Beckett, of course, is up at Tristan looking over the
downs and yes, side by side, yes. Yes, right, yes. Well, now, Arthur, maybe we'll go outside and have a look around. On the east side of the doorway is the ancient holy water stoup. This, unfortunately, of course, has been cut away. It was hexagonal in shape. But it is beautifully carved, and you can see the cusps at the top, just as almost as they were when it was first done. But this could have been at the time of the Reformation, which was like the other part of the holy water stoup was removed.
In this spot here in the churchyard, we could look at the grave here of the Parson Darby, whose Vincent's plan is rather weathered, but still distinctly readable.
Yes, indeed, yes. Well, I'll try and read it to you. Here lies the body of Parson Darby, vicar of East Dean, who died on the 26th of October, 1726. He was the sailor's friend. So of course, this was the parson who left his wife to go out in the time of the storm down to the cave that he had cut in the, or enlarged rather, in the chalk cliffs of Dunkeith.
Now we come up under an oak tree with a beautiful Tudor house in front of us, and we're looking towards the tower. Which is
right. Well, here is the first church, as we said, the Tariform Church, built as a protection, probably as a place where the villagers could come for safety if they were attacked by the invaders. And the three tiers, you see, stand out very clearly, the layers of the tower. And you can see just down below now the small semicircular apse, which was a part with the church, when it was simply a tower and a church.
Do they have bells in the tower, sir?
Yes. Unfortunately, the bells are not rung as we would hope they would be, because the bell frames are in a weakness. But they are rung on occasion, and we hope that later on, it was possible to have a bell in his back and the bells.
How many bells is it?
That's five, if I may. I saw that the number, I must check that afterwards. Yes. Anyway, we all make mistakes sometimes. Well, just the actual change of the church, you see, it's interesting that they didn't use the church, the original church, at all, but simply built their nave and choir against it. This always produces problems as far as the rain is concerned and the general weaknesses of one wall butting onto the other, but there it is. The other part of the church garden, of course, is now taken up with the memorial garden at the corner below, but the interments are still made, and the tombs of the manor are there in the corner over here.
In the southeast corner?
Yes.
The distinction about this churchyard that we find not only were the mariners from the 17th and 18th century buried here, but we have quite a few of the last war to God alone is known.
Yes, that's true. Both churches are. And also, of course, there were the German airmen who were buried before they were reinterred over the dead and taken to Cannock Chase. But before that, there were quite a number of the airmen who had been found on the downs who were buried in these two churches.